coming up.
What's the difference between charitable giving from ordinary people and philanthropic giving from the 1%?
Collectively, they're worth an estimated $13 billion, which has enabled the Sackler family to proudly slap their name on some truly impressive monuments to other people's talents.
Whose interests are served when the super rich give big?
Isn't big philanthropy just papering over the enormous cracks in our economic system?
Keep in mind that these people have infinite money and seem to enjoy nothing more than using it to purchase social status.
Money don't get everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money.
Philanthropy is an exercise of power. It's an attempt to convert private wealth into public influence.
Our guest is Stanford political scientist Rob Reich.
Power, especially if it's concentrated power with very large donors, is something that deserves scrutiny, not gratitude, or at least not only gratitude.
Is philanthropy bad for democracy?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This year, it's been everything from cancel culture to contradictions, from wise women to weird wants.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click Support Us at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life with a subscription to our library of nearly 600 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Is philanthropy driven by compassion or by ego?
Is it better if the rich hoard their money or if they give it away?
How about taxing them and using the money the way we want?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
And I'm Josh Landy, coming to you this week from the Windy City in the studios of the Chicago Recording Company.
But we're still continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking whether philanthropy is bad for democracy.
Josh, what kind of question is that? Philanthropy pays both of our salaries. It funds scholarships for needy students. It builds libraries, hospitals, museums. What's not to like?
Those are great things, especially my salary. But we can't let them blind us to the corrosive harm that philanthropy actually does, especially to democracy.
What? Philanthropy corrosive? To democracy? Come on, Josh.
Well, ask yourself why exactly we need to bribe rich people into giving their money away using tax breaks. I mean huge tax breaks. I mean, all that does is basically reduce the overall sum of money that government has to spend on all the things we need.
Wait, would you rather rich people hoard their money?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is instead we should tax them more, a lot more.
You don't want to bribe the rich. You want to soak the rich. Is that it?
Well, something like that. I mean, the thought is this. Look, instead of rewarding them for wasting money on monuments to their own vanity, we, the people, should get to decide, democratically, how to spend that money on things that matter to all of us.
Monuments to their vanity? Come on, Josh. You're making it sound like most philanthropists are driven by ego rather than selfless compassion.
Ego, a lust for power, a desire for absolution.
Jeepers.
Yes. I mean, look, think about who these philanthropists actually are. I mean, back in the Gilded Age, it was people like Rockefeller and Carnegie. And today, it's the likes of Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers. I mean, you're really telling me you trust the motives of people like that?
Oh, gosh, Josh. Look, I can't deny that there have been some unsavory characters among the pantheon of great philanthropists. But, you know, there's also the likes of George Soros or Bill Gates. They seem like pretty cool guys, and I'm sure their politics are much more to your liking.
Hey, look, it's not the politics that's the issue. I mean, the point is that these folks didn't make their billions by being selflessly compassionate. They made them by, you know, rigging the system or being ruthless robber barons.
Oh, gosh. First of all, why, suppose you're right. Why does it matter how they made their money? All that really matters is what they're doing with the money they've got now that they've switched from, you know, robber baron mode to philanthropic mode. That's all that matters.
I don't know, Ken. Dress a rubber baron up in philanthropic clothing? All you got is a rubber baron in a friendly-looking suit.
Oh, gosh, who are you, dude? Bernie Sanders? It's like you think that all great wealth is ill-gotten. I mean, I don't believe that, but even if it were, shouldn't we be pleased? I mean, like, really pleased when some of it is given back to society?
So wait, we're supposed to be grateful to them, like they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart? I mean, haven't you noticed how often they plaster their names all over everything they build?
Oh, gosh. Josh, a wealthy donor gives like $30 million to build a cancer center. And you begrudge them a little name recognition? What's so bad about giving credit where credit's due, dude?
Well, so let me see if I understand you correctly. You're saying we're supposed to take their tainted money, ignore who we are, who they are, ignore where their money came from, and then bow down before them and say, thank you so much, oh saintly one, for building us a monument in your honor. Thanks, but no thanks.
Oh, gosh, in your honor. Come on, Josh, let me get this straight. I mean, it's like you think, I mean, do you really think, like, philanthropy is a form of, I don't know, it's like the moral equivalent of money laundering or something like that. Come on.
Well, yeah. Yes. I mean, look, it's a way for the Rockefellers of this world to disguise the unscrupulous means by which they made their money. And it's also a way for them to whitewash their reputation.
Oh, gosh, this is way too harsh, Josh. Come on. Surely, some philanthropists are just good, caring people who made their money honestly, and they're interested now in using their wealth to change the world and make it a better place. Surely you admit there are people like that.
Well, okay, and more power to them if they are, but, Ken, if they're really such great people, why do we need to bribe them to give their money away using tax breaks?
Well, I'm willing to admit you might be right about that. We should maybe rethink our tax policies, no doubt. Okay.
It's good to see you're starting to come around.
But still, I think you're way too cynical about this question of how many philanthropists are genuine saints and how many are just sinners in disguise.
You know, that's an excellent question, Ken. And to help us think about it, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to take a closer look at the motivations of some well-known philanthropists from the Gilded Age down to the present. She files this report.
In a recent HBO segment, comedian John Oliver takes on the Sackler family and their company, Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin.
Purdue famously aggressively marketed OxyContin to doctors as a less addictive painkiller that could be used to treat common conditions like backaches and knee pain, which was obviously untrue.
The Sacklers have rarely spoken publicly about this addictive painkiller, so Oliver brought on actor Michael Keaton to play Richard Sackler.
A news article about OxyContin addiction says it's caused 59 deaths in a single state. How do you respond?
That's not too bad. It could have been far worse.
In 2001, the opioid crisis was escalating. Richard Sackler wrote an email urging Purdue Pharma staffers to blame the people who were addicted.
Michael Keaton, what did he actually write?
We have to hammer on the abusers in every way possible. They are the culprits and the problem. They are reckless criminals.
Sackler genuinely wrote that.
It's time, Guggenheim, to take down the man.
Outraged by the family's actions, activists took to the Guggenheim in New York to demand the museum cut ties with the Sackler family.
400,000 dead!
In response to public pressure, museums like the Guggenheim have begun to cut ties. The National Portrait Gallery in the UK canceled a $1.3 million donation from the Sackler family.
And I think the Sackler family cares about that.
Keith Humphreys researches addiction at Stanford University.
They are so insistent on putting their name on all their philanthropic donations, says to me they really want to be known as patrons of the arts, not as the people who brought us the worst drug epidemic of the last 100 years.
Humphrey says the Sacklers used their social clout to convince regulators, medical schools, and doctors that OxyContin was not addictive. He says rejecting their donations sends a powerful message.
Rich people aren't like you and me. They care a lot about being able to go to dinner parties in fancy places and not be cursed under people's breath. So that elite rejection by museums, and I suspect some universities are going to start rejecting them as well, may motivate them to change, not out of any goodness of their heart, but because they care about that very deeply, maybe more than they care about just the money.
this is not the first time institutions have grappled with accepting donations from the contentious elite.
Big philanthropy is inherently a problem for democracy.
Benjamin Soskus, a historian with the Center on Nonprofits and Philanthropy at the Urban Institute, says this debate really came to a head during the Gilded Age. This was after the Civil War, when oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller became America's first billionaire. Andrew Carnegie was another robber baron. He made a fortune off of steel and ruthlessly broke up unions.
The massive fortunes of the Industrial Age confronted the public with a real quandary. What do you do if you are asked to accept public donations that are really attractive, that could do good, but that seem to connote a sort of endorsement of the modes of accumulation?
Some communities refused Carnegie's money, saying the libraries he wanted to build were like monuments to exploitation. In 1905, Rockefeller donated $100,000 to Congregationalist Missionary Society. Soskus says this sparked widespread debate about whether accepting this money would amount to endorsing a merciless oil monopoly.
And that's when the phrase tainted money really became most prominent. Half the nation thought it was cool for the Congregationalists to accept the money, and half thought it was completely immoral.
During the 19th century, it was easy to point to millionaires and philanthropists like Rockefeller and Carnegie as examples of corporate greed. Now the Sacklers have come to represent a similar ethos. But Andy Chambers, an addiction psychiatrist with the Indiana University School of Medicine, says focusing on individuals like the Sacklers is missing the bigger picture.
What's going on in our healthcare system that doctors are so poorly trained that they, instead of listening to what they were taught in med school, they listen to drug companies? What's going on with that?
Now we're in what some people call the second Gilded Age, where a small number of people yet again own a huge chunk of the nation's wealth. And many of these very rich individuals are looking to make big donations. Chambers says addiction research might be a good place to start.
There is an incredible lack of philanthropic interest and support for addiction diseases.
But when it comes to fighting addiction, there's not usually a prestigious museum wall for billionaires to stamp their names on. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
And thanks for that fascinating tour of debates about philanthropy from the old Gilded Age down to the new Gilded Age. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today, we're asking whether philanthropy is bad for democracy.
We're joined now by Rob Riche, who's a professor of political science at Stanford University, where he also directs the Center for Ethics in Society. And he's the author most recently of a book called Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. Rob, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So, Rob, despite the title of your book, I'm guessing that at some point you were like most Americans. I doubt that most Americans see philanthropy as all that corrosive for democracy. So tell me, what was your aha moment when you were opened, your eyes were open to the downsides of philanthropy for the first time?
Yeah, there was an aha moment, and it wasn't by thinking as a scholar and looking at Rockefeller and all these other Gilded Age or Second Gilded Age barons. It came in a kind of humdrum way. Like you, I live in the Bay Area, relatively wealthy suburbs here in the peninsula, and had my first child getting ready to send him off to kindergarten in Palo Alto. On the first day he was in school, got sent home with a whole bunch of information about welcome to the school district, registration for class, et cetera, and an invitation from the school district's foundation to send a voluntary but expected contribution of $2,000 wow. per child that year. That was really something. And so I put on my scholar hat. I had been writing a lot about education opportunity, and collected some data about these private donations to public schools and found exactly what you'd predict. They exacerbate inequalities in school funding. Wealthy suburbs can raise a lot more money than can big cities or poor places. And then the really galling thing, that on top of the exacerbation of inequality, parents in Palo Alto got tax deductions for these contributions. And so the federal government, and by extension all American citizens, were adding fuel to the fire, or were themselves helping out wealthy parents add more advantage to already relatively advantaged kids.
So let me see if I have you right, Rob. It sounds like in the disagreement that Ken and I were having a moment ago, You're a little bit closer to the position I was pushing, right? I was being a little tough maybe on through that specific group.
And
Ken was more inclined. Ken was more inclined to give them a pass, appreciate the good that they do. So, where do you stand on this? Or, are most of today's philanthropists saintly, do-gooding types? Or are they more like the rubber barons of old times?
Yeah, well, we're on Philosophy Talks. So let's make an important initial distinction. There's a kind of backward-looking accounting of the money-making itself, the mode of accumulation, and then whether you can sort of excuse any ill-gotten gains by doing something philanthropic. And then there's just a forward-looking question to be asked about whether charity or philanthropy does something that actually has to do with poverty reduction or almsgiving.
Right.
And, the example I like to give about the Rockefeller or the Sacklers is, Ken, I see you're wearing a nice watch right now. If I were to steal your watch and then go down to the pawn shop down the street, sell it for a couple $100, and then go to a super effective charity and give them the couple $100, and then you come find me and complain, like, dude, you stole my watch. And I say, but Ken, look at the amazing good that I've done with
right,
this.
Right. That's the money laundering.
That's the money laundering bit. Right. Exactly. And so my good deed doesn't excuse the initial harm. But I'm going to give the Palo Alto parents a pass here. Let's just assume that they have money that's legitimately theirs and there are no robber baron harms done. Still, there are important questions to be asked. Should we have a system of charity that allows people to, instead of directing their altruistic, other-regarding philanthropic donations to assist people in need, actually then adds advantage to advantage and add a taxpayer subsidy?
I know your answer to that. But what we're going to do, that's what they call a rhetorical question.
It is.
What we're going to do, though, is take you up on that after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about philanthropy and democracy with Rob Reich from Stanford University.
Is trusting the public good to philanthropists a form of plutocracy? What if the people and their representatives decide not to fund the arts or shows like Philosophy Talk? Wouldn't we want philanthropists to step up?
Providing public goods, plutocracy versus democracy. When Philosophy Talk, it continues.
Yeah, a different city every night. Oh, I swear the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire.
Become a billionaire and use philanthropy to turn your private wealth into public influence. That's the ticket. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're asking whether philanthropy is bad for democracy. Our guest is Rob Reich from Stanford, author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better.
So, Josh, Rob, I want to ask you a question that's kind of the flip side. You gave us a case in which you thought, plausibly, philanthropy and the way we structure it undermines the public good and our shared values and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But consider a different kind of case. A city with a declining tax base, barely enough money to provide basic service, some big-time philanthropist steps in, builds parks and playing fields that the city really wants but can't afford. Isn't that sort of thing in the public interest?
It might well be, and I think we should examine that closely to decide whether it is. And the key there is we should examine it and scrutinize it. So in a case of a city with a declining tax base, you need to have a bunch of public services. And if philanthropists want perhaps to fund them, first we should ask about the tax incentives that attach to it. We already went there, so let's leave that aside. But then do we want donor strings? Do we want all of our public parks to be named after our grand philanthropists? And then the other thing I think is just relevant to point out here, that we have to ask questions about the power that these wealthy people are wielding in our public setting. So these public parks are meant to belong to citizens, belong to us, and yet we now have this dependence upon private wealth.
Well, but go back to the schools and your Palo Alto Education Foundation and the Los Altos the reason that thing exists is because the state of California, when my son was in school, was 47th in per capita spending on education, because partly because the voters of California have decided they're happy to be that way. So the voter, turn it all over to the voters? Well, yeah, right. And then we'll get 47th per capita spending on public education.
Good. I hear the same exact thing about the school donations. Well, if California could actually get itself together to have a decent school finance system, then we wouldn't have to do these donations.
Right.
But that suggests to me Stop acting as a donor for your nice little wealthy suburb. Start acting as a citizen to get at the root of the problem, which is in Sacramento. Or at the very least, get the school foundation to do both. Organize the parents in Los Altos to troop off to Sacramento in order to complain about the root source of the problem.
Oh, but the parents in my town, they do. A lot of politically activist people in my town. And we pass parcel tax and all of them. There are lots of Democrats in my town, despite the fact that we're in this really, and they're political activists. They knock on doors for elections. But the state of California is a mess.
Yes.
It is an utter mess. It's very difficult to govern.
All right, let me ask one more question then about that, because I think it's important to notice that there's a dynamic that could get set in motion that I wonder if you worry about. I certainly do. People donate a bunch of money, or the wealthy people come in and supply the money for the parks and the libraries and the public spaces. And then the legislature, which is asking questions about whether it should continue to try to do this, now says, oh, look, a bunch of wealthy people or rich people in Zotas have stepped in. We don't need to fix this anymore.
Yeah, Josh, you wanted to get in here earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's like these crowdfunding campaigns for people who have some kind of health issue. And,
right.
On the one hand, it's heartwarming. On the other hand, it speaks to a real failure of our system. That these, even when some big philanthropist builds a hospital, you wonder to yourself, why was that necessary? And is it just papering over the cracks in a system that is somehow failing us all? But that's one issue. I also want to get back to something you were saying earlier about influence, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I don't care if someone builds a park and has influence over that park, but I care if somebody builds a school and has influence over that school. I read that there was a foundation, like the Broad Foundation, that made this big grant to the New Jersey Board of Education with a condition that Chris Christie had to remain the governor.
Yes.
And when things like that are happening, you start to worry whether, in fact, this money is being used to put a thumb on the scale of public policy. Is that something that concerns you?
Absolutely. The donor influence there is really important. And I think there are even some places where our intuition suggests that there are kinds of public services that belong properly to the people and to citizens as a whole. So here's an example I give in the book. Imagine instead of giving money to schools, the block that you live on in Los Altos or Chicago or Palo Alto, San Francisco, wherever, there's a crime wave. And it's because the budget's been cut for the police department. And instead of going to city council or badgering the mayor, you and your folks on the block decide to pony up a bunch of money and donate it to the police department with the condition that with this money they hire a new police officer whose only beat is your block.
Well, where Josh is at the University of Chicago in Hyde Park, because of the crime on the south side of Chicago and the problematic nature of the Chicago police force, the University of Chicago has in effect done exactly that. It's hired a private police force that augments the policing of Hyde Park, right, reports to the university. They are somehow empowered to police by the city. So
they're accountable to the university, not to citizens?
They're accountable to the police department, but they're hired and paid for by the University of Chicago. You would say that's a crazy thing.
At a minimum, morally and politically complicated. And I begin to worry that this is an example of wealthy people or a relatively wealthy university directing what is effectively a public service of the most basic sort, providing security for people.
But so you say, how is philanthropy failing democracy, right?
Yes.
But how is democracy failing democracy? Because why does the University of Chicago do that? Because the Chicago police are underfunded, under-resourced. And who did that?
Yes.
The University of Chicago didn't do that.
Of course not.
I mean, who's failing democracy more, philanthropy or democracy?
And if we stop acting as citizens and instead act as donors, then that failure and dysfunction of democracy will just persist. We have to act in our civic capacity as well as in our capacity as a donor.
Well, okay. I mean, look, I'm very sympathetic to this line of argument, but let me make an obvious objection. Let's say we succeed in shifting these funds essentially into the government. What's the guarantee that the government's going to spend them any more wisely? I mean, think about, I don't want to name any names of current, folks who might be responsible for disbursing funds in education. But how can we be guaranteed that these funds will actually be spent better, mm-hmm. All things considered, than if they were being given by private donors?
Well, there's certainly no guarantee. You're right about that. But I think that points to something about democracy. So you're right. The standpoint of this book is to think about the role that philanthropy plays in a democracy. And the argument I want to give about democracy is that it's not meant to be a mechanism for maximally effective public spending. Effectiveness, yes, but effectiveness where people have a voice and you can course correct over time, not outsource things for dependence upon private donors and the strings that they may attach and the influence they may want to wield. That's where the issue is. Democracy is good for confronting and solving social problems in oftentimes slow and inefficient ways rather than relying upon the beneficence of technocratic philanthropists.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philanthropy and whether it undermines democracy. And Melissa's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Melissa.
Hi. So I'm really happy to hear this being discussed. This is the kind of corruption that I have been dealing with for the last 7 years as a teacher. And I've seen my students' parents who work two jobs in order to afford to live in the Bay Area, sometimes three, asked to bring supplies to school that we can't afford to purchase, like paper, like tissue, like pencils. And it's unconscionable that we purport to have education for all, and yet students are not given the tools that they need. And we were just told by the principal for the school that I work with now that we can't bring, that the school's not going to be able to pay for composition books anymore, and those need to be provided either by the foundation for our school, which I'm working in a different district, we're lucky enough to have, or provided by parents. Parents are already paying taxes. So I have two questions. The first one is, where can we go that this will be heard? Because I've been complaining about this for a long time, and people aren't listening to me as an individual, and I need more people behind me. The second is, businesses get rates for crayons that are phenomenally cheap, and yet my parents are expected to pay full price for those crayons. Why are people not able to take advantage of that? That's my second question.
Thanks, Melissa. So, Rob, you want to take either of those? Where does she go and why?
I mean, well, maybe places you've been already, I'd say you go to the school board to complain. Make sure that the people who are at the leadership of the district know about this issue, because you're exactly right that you don't want to end up relying on donations for things as essential as books and paper to write on. And I mean, I guess what I want to say here is that the best that we should be able to say about donations to local schools is that they are a second best mechanism. We want to ensure that the basic services are provided collectively, and that's a collective civic responsibility.
I want to go back to something you said about democracy, which I think is really true. Democracy may or may not produce optimal solution to coordination problems and shared problems. It may or may not. You know, there are lots of, I don't know if you ever saw that Lifeboat or whatever it was called, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, when the Germans looked like they were going to send it, and all the democracies were like, and you know, you could have the belief during that time, democracy sucks.
Yes.
Totalitarianism finds the optimal solution.
Right.
I don't think that's true, but it's an open question whether democracy, democratic self-government, is going to walk relentlessly toward the optional solution. So, there needs to be a space in the public domain, in civic life, for experimentation that is not the government's experimentation.
Right.
Especially given the short timelines. I mean, these people are in power for maybe 4 years, and they we need solutions that are looking at a very long time horizon.
So private individuals using their ingenuity, their creativity, their compassion, and their wealth say, I'm not going to wait for the government to democracy going to settle this. I'm going to try out something.
Yep, right. So that's the case I want to make on behalf of philanthropy. And here in particular, big philanthropy, this plutocratic element in democratic setting, you put your finger on it really well. In our public agencies, we have deliberately built in short time horizons because of elections. You can't take a 20-year bet with a bunch of public money with no expectation that there's a return on it. But philanthropists are perhaps distinctively able to do that. And so if what philanthropists do is take a kind of long-time horizon social problem-solving approach in which the successful experiments are presented to the rest of the citizens as a kind of evidence-based innovation, That would be a really good function. You know, to put it in a wonky way, philanthropy, when it works well for democracy, is an extra governmental mechanism for discovery and innovation.
That sounds positively Millian, like
Indeed.
Something right out of John Stuart Mill. Am I right? Because Mill talked about experiments and living.
Yes.
And the experiments and living, they run, some fail, some succeed, but they're a huge complex feedback mechanism that feed into our trying to figure out what's the best way to live.
Exactly right. But I'd add to it, I don't want this to be seen as just, you know, to celebrate the existing activities of big philanthropists, because part of what successful philanthropy looks in the mode we just described, this Millian mode or the discovery mode, is looking to the public sector itself as the ultimate scaling device for a successful innovation, not saying of the public sector, we have to do this philanthropy because it's so dysfunctional and broken and it's so inefficient and sclerotic that the wise people will now do things in a technocratically better way.
I get that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about whether philanthropy undermines democracy. And Ed in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Ed, what's your comment or question?
Okay, well, you've gone way on before I go into much more detail. But I do have a point, I think. I don't know what percentage of people actually give money to philosophy who get rich. I mean, what percentage does Jeff Bezos give to the world? You've got the technocrats, the new technocrats of running, you know, Facebook and all these places who have amassed a great deal of wealth at the expense of the people working for them. And that includes Apple and just about any of these corporations you can name. I'm wondering, however, I mean, given the situation, that has to be changed politically if possible, given the amount of money they have. But the fact that somebody's actually giving some money back is perhaps a small percentage of these people. I mean, is it something to be thrown away simply because it's not morally correct?
So thanks for the question, Ed. I mean, he's asking, I mean, what's the scope of philanthropic giving and what percentage of great wealth does it represent and why not welcome it?
Yep. Good. So let me just give you some facts there to the excellent question. Last year in the United States, about $410 billion given away. And there's what's known as the famous U-shaped curve of giving. The percentage of one's own wealth or income that you give away in any given year is highest when you're poor, goes down to about 1% to 2% of your income in the middle class, and then goes back up for the very wealthy. So on average, people give away, roughly speaking, 2% of their income in any given year. The rates of giving are indeed very high. 90, 95% of people give something. But it's not an equivalent percentage across all income classes.
So,
and what do you think, Rob, is good model of something currently? You know, for example, Bill Gates tackling malaria. I mean, do you have examples of people who you think are currently essentially doing it right?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to point to some examples of philanthropists who seem to be doing something in the democratically supportive mode I have in mind, I look at the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, which is based out of Houston, Texas. I happen to think the Gates Foundation does a lot of things that are terrific as well. But again, I want to emphasize the point of my book is not to inspect the particular causes of any given philanthropist, is to think about the public policies that structure all of philanthropy. Because if all we did in examining philanthropy is to say, I like what the Gateses do, but I don't like what Bloomberg does or Soros does or whatever, we're just expressing our policy preferences as ordinary citizens. The point is to inspect the structure itself and the incentives that exist for the giving.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about philanthropy and democracy with Rob Reich, author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better.
In our final segment, we'll ask how to change philanthropy so that it serves democracy rather than undermining it.
Fixing the future of philanthropy when Philosophy Talk continues. Rich, powerful, and democratically unaccountable. That's Philanthropy in America. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Stanford political scientist Rob Riche, and we're thinking about whether philanthropy is bad for democracy.
And we've got a caller on the line, Marilyn from San Francisco. Marilyn, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. I have a comment. I have had a long career as a philanthropic consultant on the fundraising side. So there's been a lot of study done about what motivates people to give, and I noticed that hasn't quite been addressed yet. There were studies done years ago that showed maybe 7% of all philanthropic giving was motivated by altruism, maybe a similar amount more to contribute to one's community. And the rest was all the different motives that you have been discussing, and as it is a serious stream of money, $410 billion last year, there's a potential for a lot of abuse and twisting and personal aggrandizement, as you've been saying. But to saying that philanthropy is bad or might be bad for democracy is like saying business might be bad for philanthropy. The field's been very resistant to any kind of regulation, just as business has. So everything you've been saying is true, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Right. So thanks for the call. Lots of thoughts there.
Yeah.
I mean, true, business, I'm not a socialist. I don't believe we should seize the means of production. I don't believe that a government that occupies, you know, the high ground, the commanding heights of the economy plans better than all those people, right? But I do believe that business can't provide for all public goods.
That's
the
right.
Market doesn't provide, just will not provide yep. certain public goods. So I believe in a mixed economy.
Right.
Right. I really believe in a mixed economy. And I think philanthropy must be part of a mixed economy.
I think that's right. And Marilyn's question, I think, was partly about how allergic business and philanthropy has been to any type of reform, or allergic to the idea of reform. And I'll point to one possible hopeful sign about what might be coming. The tax bill that Trump passed made it the case, by increasing the standard deduction, that very, very few people will be able to itemize their charitable contributions. It will really be mainly the wealthy who can do that. And that will mean that charitable giving across those $410 billion looks more and more like it's a policy-supported mechanism just for rich people, and that the rest of us who do give money basically do it completely on our own dime. And then that might open up a window for some possible change, because one of the real problems about philanthropy, in my view, is not just that there's a plutocratic element of wealthy people controlling what kind of public goods happen, but that the policy mechanism itself, the tax deduction for charitable giving, is plutocratic itself. It overweights the interests of the wealthy as against the middle class and poor.
Okay, so we're getting to solutions now. I mean, on Philosophy Talk, we sometimes appoint people czars, you know, with the powers vested in us. So we're going to appoint you czar of the world. We're giving you total power just for one day.
Yeah, so much for democracy.
Seriously.
But it's all in the service. Solutions here.
Right? So your remit is to fix what's broken in philanthropy and make it fit a democratic society. So what's the first thing you do as czar of the world in that situation?
Excellent. So let's just keep on the tax incentive thing. So I think we get rid of the charitable contributions deduction, or the particular policy mechanism. Now, would that mean that people would give less if we have no incentive to give at all? Maybe. It's an open question. Keep in mind that the tax incentives for giving only came into being in 1917, when there was the creation of an income tax. People were giving money away, like the Rockefellers and Carnegies before that.
Yeah, but that was money laundering.
That was different, a different kind of money, perhaps. I'm open. In fact, what I defend in the book is the idea that we get rid of the tax deduction and we replace it with a tax credit. So, you know, this is a bit of tax wonkery here, but the idea is, if, you know, Ken, you're a billionaire and I'm an ordinary citizen, you give $1,000 to Stanford University, I give $1,000 to Stanford University, it's producing the same public good.
Right.
You get a 40% deduction on your giving. It costs you $600 to give it. I'm a middle-class person who can't itemize. It costs me the full $1,000.
Right.
That's a plutocratic bias in the mechanism itself. So instead, imagine that there was a $2,000 tax credit for each of us. You give $1,000, you get $500 back in a tax credit, capped up to $2,000 in total. I get the same $2,000 tax credit. The policy weights our voice identically. You're free to give after you've used up your whole $2,000 tax credit, but then it's completely on your own dime.
Oh, so the credit tops out at it's like
– pick a number, right, $1,000 right, or $2,000.
Exactly. But that – I see that that flips the thing, right? The question would be, I guess, to the extent that we want a mixed economy
yep.
with markets and government provision of some goods
right.
and experimentation in the philanthropic
That's
sphere,
right.
would that disincentivize that sphere?
I mean, Marilyn asked about the motives for people to give. For some people, the motive might be tax avoidance. For others, it's a sense of duty or tithing. And so for others, especially the extremely wealthy, they have so much that a lot of people are aiming, indeed, like Carnegie, to give back some money to the society that made it possible for them to make it in the first place. So I grant that it's not a philosophical question about what would happen right. if you change the incentive. That's an empirical question. But I'm optimistic that we don't see a complete decimation of philanthropy if we radically change the incentive.
Okay.
One of the other strange things about big philanthropy in the form of foundations is that when you create a foundation, its legal default time horizon is to exist forever, in perpetuity. And a perpetual right. time horizon is a very odd yeah. legal design.
Yeah.
And, you know, the line that lawyers give about this is that what that allows is that the dead hand of the donor reaches out of the grave to strangle future generations and what their wiser decisions might be.
I got you. And I picked up on that in some of your writings. But I thought, well, see, because you kind of think the government should be able to come in and adjust this.
Or spend but, down. The oh, foundations right, right, spend right. out the money
But think
on their
about
own.
Stanford University that has yeah. a lot of these. Harvard has a huge endowment.
Right.
But a lot of it is useless to them because people endowed their 300-year-old endowments
right.
for things that Harvard no longer does.
Correct.
And they can't spend the money because and it's hard. And so Stanford has tries to get donors to give money that's as few restrictions as possible. But the donors want the restrictions because they want something done. Okay, but I don't know why the government should come in. Why can't – I mean, the government should allow mm-hmm. the recipient. It seems to me it's between the donor and the recipient, not between the donor and the government.
That's right. The donor string can exist forever. That seems fine to me in a contractual sense. But the issue is whether the assets in the foundations should be designed to live forever. I think foundations should have a time-limited existence, and their donations then can set up things that go on for right. a long time. But you know, I have to say, Ken, I think even here there's a problem at Stanford. So I think I have the details of this right. A person from the Midwest came to Stanford in the 1890s, 1910s, person's back in the Midwest as an alumnus, gives a bunch of money to Stanford to support financial aid for a student who couldn't afford the fees from the Midwest, but who arrives at Palo Alto on a horse. Stanford had to sue the family
right,
in order
exactly.
to be able to use the money in the 1930s.
Yes, right.
But should the government have stepped in and say, use the money for this, or should Stanford be free to say?
Well, the government should step in the sense of undoing the perpetual right. will of the donor. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, the university should be able, without having to sue the descendants of the initial donor for permission to change the will of the donor, should be able to repurpose the use of the money because it's not even possible to award it anymore to someone.
I want to come back to something you were saying earlier, Rob, about In an ideal world, these philanthropic foundations would be funding essentially experiments for living or experiments
right.
in public policy.
That's right.
You know, these are experiments on human subjects, right? You might have a school where you're experimenting with the lives of young people. I don't know if there's any way around this, but what do you want to say about that? I mean, is it totally responsible to allow a private foundation to do an experiment essentially on the lives of a set of children?
Yeah. Well, the thing that gives me concern about that is when private foundations or philanthropists do their experiments within an actual public school setting, within an existing public agency. If they were doing it at a private school or, you know, charter schools are perhaps the example now that are sort of privately operated but publicly accountable and publicly funded. You know, I guess I feel like we're going to need social problem solving in a democracy over long time mm-hmm. horizons. That experimentation has to happen somewhere.
Well, and I want to add, we as the democratic polity, we do these experiments.
Absolutely.
And I'm just not as convinced. I guess there's a part million in me. I'm not as convinced of the wisdom of the crowds as Josh, you seem to be. I think the crowds often take massive wrong turns. massive wrong turns. And so I think there's room for lots of What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so what I want to say about philanthropy in a slightly different way, but keeping with what you have in mind here, Ken, is that when it's working well, philanthropy can be a partly decentralized mechanism for a sort of set of social experiments that people do partly by giving money or partly by volunteering for organizations. And we have a diverse, pluralistic, contestatory civil society that's a kind of cauldron of change and innovation. And that bubbles up then into the formal public realm in which we then use our capacity as citizens to vote various things with a majority into public funding.
Well, that's a really good thought to end on. And that good thought, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Rob Reich. He's a professor of political science at Stanford University, author most recently of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. So, Josh, you got a brief last thought? Very brief?
Well, look, I just want to say my services are available for whitewashing of reputations. If you've got $1 billion to give to Philosophy Talk. But seriously, like I'm totally convinced of the problems by the problems and the solutions. But my worry is within the current economic and political climate about feasibility, maybe we'd have to change a bunch of other things first before we could really reform philanthropy.
Oh, I think we have to reform our whole social world, our whole political
right.
world. And and I do think one place to start is with more people reading Mill and digesting Chapter 3 of On Liberty, because I think that's one of the most profound things ever written. I teach it to students every year. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in the community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now here's someone who's always on the lookout for a tax break on speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, back in the Gilded Age, to prove that they were not untouched by human feelings, our little empire-building millionaires, moguls, and titans took time out from machine-gunning factory workers to fund museums and libraries and university chairs. They could have spent their waning years in hookers and cocaine. We owe them so much. In the early days of history, everything was funded by the rich. You didn't have travel on Route 66, but the King's Highway. Everything else is just a ditch you might could walk in if you paid your shilling. Art was fashioned in salons and academies funded by the wealthy. Artists had patrons and donors, or they starved. Poor people only had household gods, fashioned from rubble, which the king could seize if he thought it would look good on a castle shelf. Philanthropy is met with mixed emotions in America. It's about serving the common good, but we're a buy-your-bootstraps nation. Any helping hand reeks of socialism. Also, if government is doing it, it's probably bad. It's much better if Elon Musk helps out, or Mark Zuckerberg, or Bill and Linda Gates. They're quite generous with projects they approve of, like charter schools. They love the charter schools. See, if I were rich, I would go around defunding charter schools, use that money to pay for school supplies so public school teachers don't have to pay for it themselves, or worry about losing their jobs because conservatives and liberals have made an alliance to destroy the public school system. But that's just me. So what exactly is philanthropy? Anything that is not a bank, a market, or an insurance company. Anything guaranteed to not make money. Symphony halls, opera houses, the ballet, hospital wings, theaters, research facilities, chairs in universities, endowments, grants, scholarships. Now take art. The criticism is, if funding is left to rich people, they dictate what kind of art to fund. Well, yeah, they collect what they like, then donate it. But the vagaries of taste affect public funding as well, only it's more overtly socially conscious. These days, art installations about identity and gender get the grants. Am I wrong? I'm not wrong. Kind of explain the difference between public and private after World War I. Architect Walter Gropius was appointed to head a new institution to help rebuild the economy, the self-confidence, the self-image of Germany. It was called Bauhaus. It went on to become a major influencer in 20th century design, still being felt today. Plain steel, concrete, unornamented buildings, cheap but snazzy housing for working people, no cornices or buttresses or eaves. Keep it simple. When they came to power, though, the Nazis made it clear they would rather spend money on methamphetamines and tanks. So the faculty fled, among them Mies van der Rohe, who became an architectural cult figure. The Bauhaus influence was felt successfully in Tel Aviv, where 4,000 apartment buildings built in the White City still stand today. But not in Chicago, where the Bauhaus-inspired Cabrini-Green became a national embarrassment, also in St. Louis, where the Bauhaus-inspired Pruitt-Igoe housing complex was built in 1953 and blown up in 1972. Poor people in the United States, at least those in slap-together high-rises, do not flourish and half-baked social experiments. No matter who pays for it, the social good can be a mixed blessing. We're tired of Confederate generals, finally, and want to remove them from public squares, but this angers some. Many on Facebook were peeved that people want to rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral because Catholics are evil. Also, it's French, and who cares? Do people argue this way about the pyramids built by slaves, therefore tear them down? Also, now the Sackler family, whose name adorns libraries, museum wings, standalone museums, galleries at the Smithsonian, etc., are getting pushback. Seems the Sackler $14 billion fortune comes from OxyContin. So shut down half of East Coast art and give them back their ill-gotten gains? Well, no, I say keep the money. The Sacklers have just spent it on OxyContin and hookers. Do we want that on our conscience? Think of it as our own private bit of philanthropy, and if we have to step over the crashed bodies of addicts on our way into the museum, well, that's the price we pay for culture. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
In New York City this weekend, protesters flooded the Guggenheim Museum. They dropped fake prescription slips from the upper walkway, angry that the museum takes big donations from the Sackler family, which has been accused of engineering the opioid epidemic.